Welcome to the Statistically Insignificant Podcast with your co-hosts, Jared Hunter.
And me, Eric Drysdale.
Eric, last time we really covered a lot of Canadian politics, and so we're going to be switching it up on main topics this time, and this time we'll be diving into the world of statistics. But I wanted to ask you off the top, what is the topic that most excites you right now in the field of statistics?
So I would say that statistics really used to be a pen and paper field, in that most of the theories you could write down and just kind of work out on a page of full scrap. But now we're in the modern computer age. Right. And so a lot of the theoretical issues don't really tackle some of the applied statistics problems that we're dealing with right now. And a lot of the times it's the applied problems that we see that in turn drive statistical theory. So what does it mean to say that we're in the statistical computer age? So, you know, historically, if you wanted to run a regression model, which is a really like foundational and quite simple approach to doing certain types of statistical problems, if you wanted to do that on an old computer in the 1960s, you had to manually encode punch cards, which would take hours or a whole day to do, and then you'd run it and you'd come back the next day. Now, even the simplest laptop can run thousands of regression models in under a second. And so people, the computational challenge of running statistics has disappeared, and the number of software and applications that support complicated or basic statistical procedures has just absolutely proliferated. Right. So people without formal statistical training can basically run some of these models and get back statistical results. And even people who do have formal training also can try to tackle much more complicated problems. And so there's this issue that our tools let us do statistics quite easily, but it's not exactly clear if the theory has cut off with a lot of what we're actually doing in practice.
Right. Yeah, like I would make a note, my girlfriend has a vast knowledge of Excel. She uses that a lot. And through that tool, they're able to fit their own regression models with whatever data. So being able to make those kind of inferences and be able to fit these models so easily, it seems like statistics is almost for the everyman at this moment, right?
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the original statistical theories are based on this idea of sort of kind of a type of randomized experiment. So, you know, there might be a farmer randomly scattering seeds throughout different soil areas and seeing whether or not certain areas are more likely to grow crops effectively. And there would be good statistical methods for evaluating whether or not you found areas of land that do have better hybridization or growing abilities. But in the modern era, we don't set up things as a carefully designed randomized control trial. Most of the times what we do is we start with some data, we start playing around with it, and we get into this issue of what the Bayesian statistician Andrew Gelman refers to the garden of forking paths. This idea that if you're trying to explore a maze, there are effectively infinitely many ways to get to the end or get out of the maze. You could go all sorts of right, left, turn combinations. Mm-hmm. And while the path you take might feel natural to you, it's very obvious that if you had have backed up, say, 100 steps and gone left instead of right, you would have gone down a completely different path. And that path would have felt just as natural. So when we're doing statistics in the modern computer era, it's hard to keep track of all the small and seemingly insignificant decisions we made, turning left and turning right with the data. That would mean how we're imputing missing variables, which samples we might be dropping. Mm. And so being able to account for that with modern statistical theory just doesn't tend to work very well, because historically statistics didn't realize that we'd have computers where you'd be able to run thousands of calculations almost instantaneously.
Right. I guess that kind of leads into another topic, perhaps, where maybe you're getting at this notion of like multiple hypothesis correction, even, where people now are able to fit just hundreds of models even and potentially just find the right combination that happens to be working really well. I think this is kind of a common problem, I think, in a lot of statistical analyses, but like, can we go into what kind of practices we should be able to take in order to account for that? How can we, look out for these pitfalls and things?
Yeah, so there's let me actually just kind of give a higher level overview. The problem of multiple comparisons and statistical hypothesis testing Is a small subset of the Garden of Forking Paths problem. Oh, okay. It's actually a much simpler and controllable idea.
Right.
So again, returning to the farmer who has, say, 10 plots of land and he plants 10 different types of seeds,
mm-hmm.
there's going to be natural variation just out of random chance alone, even if all seeds have, say, equal growing potential. And so if the farmer picks the plot that has the best growth and says, this is the best seed, well, we know by definition, one of the 10 plots had to have had the best growth rate. By
yep.
definition, you have 10 plots, one of them is the best.
Yep.
Now, if they're all equal, then by random chance, one of them will randomly be at the top,
mm-hmm.
right? And so what multiple hypothesis corrections are doing is accounting for some sort of multiple measurement problem. That is that the more measurements you have, even if they're all identical, when you add random noise on top of them, and that's the point of statistics, that all measurements have randomness built into the process, you're going to pick erroneously some seeds that aren't actually any better than other ones, potentially.
Right.
And so that's what multiple hypothesis corrections does, that the more measurements you make, the larger a difference has to be because you know you will just see more extreme results by random chance alone the more measurements you make. Now, the Garden of Forking Paths, that is a problem within that subset, but it's even much more general. Because when you're doing data analysis more generally, there's all sorts of decisions, not just, say, how many measurements am I going to make, but there's all the different ways that you encode the data before you make the measurements or after you make the measurements. That's a much more challenging problem. So to give a classic example, there was some really shoddy work done by Harold Bem in the Audis, and so this was a well-known psychologist, and he published in a top journal, and he showed, I'm putting that in quotation marks, that humans had the ability of ESP, that is that they could sense something before it actually happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what he did was he had humans basically predict whether or not an image that was about to be revealed was of type A or type B. And there were
right.
different categories of type A and type B. So it might be animal. So A would be cat, B would be dog. And then there was also, strangely, and I'm not making this up, one was erotic and non-erotic type images. And for some reason, humans had a better than 50% chance of being able to guess whether they were erotic or non-erotic.
Right.
Right. Again, just because you had so many comparisons of A, B type images of different categories that eventually one category would appear to be better than random. But
yes.
we know that was just inevitably going to happen if you kept making all of these goofy category multipliers.
Yeah. So I think I've heard of particular corrections for this phenomenon. So I've heard like Bonferroni correction, where you essentially just divide the p-values by the number of trials. Are there more elegant solutions, or is the Bonferroni really one of the ways to go?
And so this gets really just to one problem of what exactly are our original statistics doing? So just even ignoring the multiple hypothesis testing correction issue, let's just say you had one statistical test you were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
The usual metric that is done in scientific research is something called a p-value, which represents the probability, or this is how it's commonly understood, the probability that a test result would be as significant as it was in the world where there is actually no underlying effect. So
yes.
to give an example of that, let's say that in reality there's no underlying height difference between men and women, but just through a random sample, this group of men appeared to be taller than this group of women. Now,
mm-hmm.
if there was no difference, the difference in height has to be bounded by some probability, right, as a function of the sample size. And that's what the p-value calculates. So if a p-value is, say, 1%, it means that if there was no difference between men and women's height, then only 1 out of 100 times would we ever get a random sample that had this different of height measurements between the two groups.
Right, and that's why if the p-value is small enough, then you would reject that null hypothesis or that hypothesis that there was no difference between the two groups.
Exactly. And it's intuitive, this idea being that, you know, we could be in this world of no difference, but if this world of no difference happens to only result in tests 1 in a million times, do we really think we're in that 1 of a million?
Yeah, it's very unlikely.
It's very unlikely.
Right.
So what multiple hypothesis corrections does is try to map that individual p-value to, say, more of a multiple hypothesis approach. So what you've described, Bonferroni, is one of the two categories of adjustments. So that's what we call family-wise error corrections, and the other ones are what we call false discovery rate corrections.
Mm.
Now, let me just back up again to the p-value in the single test case. The usual criterion is 5%. So if you get a p-value smaller than 5%, we reject the null. That is that if this only happens 1 in 20 times, we don't think that that is frequent enough for us to actually be in that world.
Right.
So we think we're probably in the world where the null is not true. Mm-hmm. What family-wise error corrections do is, instead of saying the probability that this test result is extreme, as what we observe, it's the probability that any test result could be as extreme as we're observing. So that accounts for, say, if we do 1,000 comparisons, then if there is no effect, then the 5% equivalent basically says that we will never reject the null for all 1,000 cases no more than 5% of the time. So it's a much more stringent standard, because you now have to set a criterion that is in practice much, much more strict, because you can't let any of the 1,000s be rejected.
Right.
And that's the difference. So in the single test case, we said we won't reject this single test more than 5% of the time when it's not true.
Yep.
And now we're saying is that we will not reject any of the 1,000s more than 5% of the time when we repeat this experiment multiple times.
I'm a bit confused in how you would set that model up. Can we think of like an example of where you would rerun that again? Maybe with the height example again.
So I think maybe the more common case where this is used is in genetics.
Oh, okay.
So let's say we're measuring 1,000 genes, and we want to ask the question, are these genes different? I'll stick between men and women, because this is our running example.
Okay.
And let's assume that these genes have no sex-related characteristics, and so there really shouldn't be any difference between them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Imagine we're doing this test with these 1,000 genes between men and women, but we're not just going to do this test once. We're going to go around the world and collect many pairs of men and women.
Yeah.
And measure their genes and do that many, many times.
Okay.
Okay? So each of those groups, we either reject one or more tests or we don't.
Right.
Okay? One or more tests. That's all that counts. So instead of having a rejection of 10 tests, 20 tests, I don't care. If I reject one, I count that as a rejection overall. If I reject two, I count that as a rejection overall.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
Now, if I do this across all these different male and female group pairs across the world, what the Bonferroni will ensure me is that in only 5% of those experiments will I reject at most one. Okay? So 95% of the experiments, not a single gene will be rejected.
Okay.
And in 5% of those experiments, one or possibly more genes could be rejected.
Okay.
So it's a very, very stringent standard.
Right, right.
Now, these ideas are hard. Even I'm having a hard time even putting them into words right now, because they're quite conceptually tricky.
Mm-hmm.
A more intuitive approach, instead of the family-wise error correction, is what we call the false discovery rate.
Okay.
And this is much, much more intuitive for people to understand. There's this idea that there are tests that I reject, and there are tests that I don't reject. For the tests that I reject, I'm saying that there is some effect,
okay?
So of all the tests that I reject, the false discovery rate bounds the number of those tests where there is actually no effect, okay? So if I have a false discovery rate of 10%, I'm saying that of all the tests I reject, no more than 10% of them will be erroneous rejections,
right.
i.e. what we call false positives, or the false positive rate.
Okay.
Will not be more than 10%. And so now what that means that is, if I say let's say I tested 100,000 genes. Well, actually, humans only have 25,000 genes. So I say I tested 25,000 genes between two groups of humans, males and females, people of different ethnicities or different ages, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I found 1,000 statistically significant genes at the naive p-value, so before adjustment. Right. What I'm saying is that if the false discovery rate was 10%, no more than 100 of those 1,000 genes on average will actually be false positives.
That seems to make sense that you would want to be able to put that kind of a restriction on, well, because obviously you don't want these false positives from your tests, right? Mm-hmm. Like you want to be able to say, oh, we've rejected the null, and then have strong faith that you found a real effect.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean in practice when you're going to actually put that kind of bound on these tests with the false discovery rate?
Well, the practical mm-hmm. difference usually between family-wise error and false discovery rate is that mm-hmm. family-wise error is much more conservative, which means that I'm going to detect fewer genes if there are actual differences.
Okay.
So this is what we call the power of a test. Mm-hmm. So in mm-hmm. frequentist statistical thinking,
okay.
there is two worlds. There is the world where your hypothesis is true, and there's the world where your hypothesis is false.
Right.
And the default hypothesis is that there is no effect. Unless told otherwise, you always assume the null hypothesis is that there is no effect.
Right, makes sense.
So in the world where all hypotheses are true, that there is no effect, that there is no underlying effect, then every rejection of the null represents a false positive.
Mm-hmm.
Concomitantly, in the world where every null is false, that is that there is a true effect, then every failure to reject the null represents a false negative, that you have failed to reject something that you should have.
Right.
So the power represents the second world, where there are true effects, but we don't reject the null. In other words, we say there is no effect, but there actually was one. And this is just a fundamental trade-off. So if you, say, are doing 10,000 tests, and only one of them you should actually reject. So in the gene case, of 10,000 genes, 9,999 of them have absolutely no effect for whatever biological measurement you're setting up. Then the odds that you happen to only reject the null for the one that you should is just going to be very, very small,
right?
And so we'd say your power in that situation is low. Now, your power is going to be a function of two things. It's going to be a function of the underlying signal for the test that you do want to reject,
mm-hmm.
weighted by the overall number of tests that have nulls that are true, that is, that there is no effect size. And the intuition being that it's a signal, it's a needle in the haystack, a signal-to-noise ratio problem, that the larger the haystack gets relative to that one needle, the less likely it is that if you plunge your hand into that haystack that you're going to happen to put it right where the needle is.
Right?
And so what family-wise errors adjustments tend to do is make sure that we don't have too many false positives. We don't have too many rejections of nulls when we shouldn't do it, but at the same time then it punishes the other side of the world where if there are true effects, the threshold it has to get above is just that much higher.
Right.
Because remember, it treats the 5% in the family-wise error is whether it's one rejection or 10, it doesn't matter. It counts that as a failure.
So to kind of bring it back, we've gone in pretty deep into these two particular ways of kind of controlling for this one branch of this kind of many paths.
And actually, can I just add to that? Like,
okay.
We've been diving into what these technically are, but
yeah.
Again, remember, these are absolutely necessary because there are many fields of study where you are doing so many statistical tests. Obviously, genetics is one where there
yeah.
are tens of thousands of genes, but it could be particle physics
mm-hmm.
where every collision represents a test and you want to check whether or not some new particle popped into existence.
Right.
And if we do naive approaches, we know that whatever your threshold is for the p-value, if it's 1%, 5%, 5% is standard in social science, in physics it might be, you know, 0.0001%. But
right.
we know that that percentage of tests that are not, that have no effect are going to come back as false positives.
Right.
And so the more number of tests you run, the more false positives you are just going to get. So in genetics, we can't have the case that every time we test 10,000 genes, we get back 5% of that would be 500 right. incorrect genes every time. Otherwise, we're going to keep thinking we're finding all of these biologically interesting genes, 500 right. of them every time, but almost by definition, they're all going to be false positives. Yeah. So these are absolutely essential when we're doing what we call high throughput scientific experiments, many, many tests, that we can't be overwhelmed by false positives. It right. will just grind science to a halt.
Yeah. So I think you're kind of also touching on something else that's pretty important in statistics, especially with kind of this genetics. And like, if you're someone that tends to read, I don't know, newspapers or have a casual observation of the latest genetic research, you'd almost think that we've found like thousands of different causes for cancer in particular. We are almost at this point where it does seem like we have so many of these genes that there's written literature, written papers that are saying this gene has an effect on this cancer. And yet we still feel like we're very far away from finding a good cure or really understanding all the mechanisms behind what causes these tumors, even in all these different cell types. So do you think that this is kind of part of people are not stringent enough with their, with maybe applying the Bonferroni correction or false discovery rate, or do you see this as some other issue?
No, so I have several responses to that. There's actually quite Perfect. A bit there, even though it seemed like a fairly simple question. So I think now the entire genetics and a lot of the scientific fields that do these many, many tests, mm-hmm. they totally understand family-wise and false discovery rates, and they apply the appropriate adjustments.
Okay.
And even psychology, they've come a long way from like the Daryl Bem era of
right.
research. So I think they now have pre-registered trials for a lot
That's
of things.
Good. Science is improving.
Science is improving. The point about genetics, and I mean, I'm not a biologist, but when we talk about finding these genes, so I think a lot of people, though we do have, say, 20 to 25,000 genes, those genes are combinations of basically single nucleotide polymorphisms, right?
Yeah.
These base pairs, right?
Mm-hmm.
To common human parlance, when people talk about genes, it's not clear if they're actually talking about the entire protein coding region made up of millions of base pairs, or if they're talking about the transcript level, that is the actual proteins that are getting expressed in the cells. So
okay.
the overwhelming number of these studies where you hear about differences in genes are measuring transcript differences. And
mm-hmm.
those are not the differences you are born with. Those are, say, we're treating mice with this cancer treatment. Are we noticing a change in the expression of certain transcripts of those genes? But those
right.
are very specific cases saying, like, okay, after I drink a cup of coffee, I might be able to measure a statistically significant difference in some gene transcript. It tells me very little about how that's going to generalize to, say, building drugs or overall models of biology.
Mm.
The actual the research areas where we're looking at germline differences, so that is that the genetic information that you're born with, a lot of those studies find that there's actually not a lot of variation in biological measurements that we care about that can be explained by just simply knowing the genes that you are born with, right?
Mm.
So there are a few exceptions. So say predicting the height of a child can be done. You can explain about a third of the variation
mm-hmm.
knowing their parents' genes, but things like IQ or other things, I mean, they're very, very hard to predict with your germline information alone.
Right.
This is the problem of, in the literature, I believe they call it missing heritability, that
yes.
we know that most things should be driven by genetics or the environment, and it seems unlikely that the environment is leading to, say, 80 to 90% of all outcome variation that we're measuring. So it's quite likely that genetics is a lot more complicated than we understand.
Mm.
It could be that the baseline genetic information you're born with interacts with evolving epigenetics and methylation, blah, blah, blah. The point being is that when we hear about all of these statistically significant differences in genes, it really happens to be a lot of these transcript level things that are hard to generalize and build an overall model of how biology is working. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. I'm wondering, is there really a difference for you between what's kind of most exciting about statistics field right now and then what is actually the most important question in statistics? Like, is there a linchpin in statistics that is very fundamental for us to investigate or figure out. I'm not sure.
You know, I don't actually know about the second question. I mean, I can tell you with the first one that coming up with better ways of adjusting for multiple tasks, but also not moving beyond just the probability or mathematical models of statistics, but actually now just creating a sort of statistical best practices guideline, I think is like the next exciting area. So you can think about this with like maybe like something like medicine, right? Like a lot of improvements in medicine, and I mean this at the doctor and nurse level, are not driven by better understandings of biology. They're driven by better understandings of hospital administration, protocols for doing surgery so you don't leave surgical sponges inside patients, or washing your hands or wearing gloves. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of best work practices guideline that you see in medicine could really be done better in statistics. Mm. So just basic things like, you know, old statisticians understand that you might want to split your data into like an exploratory phase and then a testing phase. And ideally, you would only ever run one set of procedures on your testing phase when you are ready.
Right.
But realistically, what happens is you run it once, then you tell your colleagues what you did and they give you more suggestions and you run it again. Mm. Having simple design systems where you could just say like, I don't know, a software, you take a popular statistical software like R or Python and you basically write a function where it locks up a test set. It's not that you can't access it. It's sort of just like putting the cookie jar on the top shelf. You're adding an extra design constraint so that you remember, oh, right, I'm not supposed to touch the test set more than once. Yeah. Or have it print out a reminder being like, hey, by the way, you've already looked at this data set before. Mm-hmm. Coming up with guidelines, protocols, and cultural practices to make sure that we're actually avoiding a lot of these garden of forking past problems. Coming up with protocols before we look at the data. Mm-hmm. Talking about what we think our exploratory design is going to look like once we see it and how we've deviated from that protocol. Right? I mean, no one expects that when you get a data set that everything you thought you were going to do is going to work out. Maybe some variables didn't come in. Maybe there's more missingness than you expected. But in the same way that you might have a pre-constructed design for a drug trial, you just have to note what the deviations in your protocol were, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, it's still very much an amateur or an honor-based system where no one questions what you did with the data, mm-hmm. right? If you were to ask an applied statistics researcher, how many regressions did you run on this data set? You're only showing me one result. Were there any more?
Yeah.
Like, it would almost be seen as an offensive question. Like, mm-hmm. in the era before doctors were required to disclose any conflicts of interest, like if I said, oh, do you have any commercial interests that might benefit from the uptake of these results you're displaying? It would be like, how dare you? Like, I am an honorable doctor. We're kind of still in that era of statistics, right? Where it's like the statistician is an honorable gentleman or gentlewoman, and they don't need to be questioned. But it's not, even with the best of intentions, you just accidentally carry out. In the same way that doctors, they don't intend not to wash their hands, but they're going to forget.
Yeah.
We need to create a culture and a set of designs around that.
Right. That framework that allows people to not have to think about it even, to just follow that, and then they'll be able to do the right thing.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't want to have to expend lots of cognitive energy to do the right thing because you're not going to do it on average.
Right. Makes sense. Okay. So there's one other big debate in statistics that I think could be interesting to touch on right now, and that is the flame war between Bayesian and frequentist statistics. So this is something that I've personally heard of, and I kind of have a rough understanding of, like, Bayesian statistics has, like, kind of a different way of looking at the world. Now, you've already touched a bit on frequentist earlier on. Maybe we'll go back into the definition for that later, but Bayesian, essentially, if I understand correctly, it allows you to apply like a prior, or that a probability represents our beliefs about what would happen in the future, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's correct. So I haven't even really mentioned anything Bayesian so far, and the examples, when I was struggling to explain to myself what family-wise error correction was, I had to basically frame it in the context of, it's not just that we're testing 1,000 genes, we're going to be testing 1,000 genes many, many times.
Yes.
And if that many approaches in infinity, That's what the statistics are trying to approximate. Right. So the frequentists are based on basically this infinite trials assumption. It's the statistics that you get as you do infinitely many trials.
Okay.
So
with these two kind of definitions, then, one of being like probability is our beliefs about what we'll have in the future, whereas a frequentist is taking out and trying to numerically measure as a trial goes to infinite runs, right? What really makes anyone kind of become a diehard Bayesian or a diehard frequentist?
Well, I think it really depends on the context. So the frequentist methods were, they started really being designed really in the 1920s with Fisher. And so frequentists are really based on this idea that you have these trials and, like, you know, some experiments have hypotheses that are totally wrong, that there's no effect, and some have experiments where there is an effect and you're trying to detect it. Mm-hmm. And that binary thinking between outcomes where there's no effect and there is an effect makes sense in the lab where you're testing these sort of scientific protocols. A Bayesian approach is more along the lines of a lot of the things that we're trying to measure in social science. Like, is there an effect of protesting on government behavior?
Okay.
Right? It's much less in we could think of, well, we're going to randomize different protests throughout the world and do that many, many times. But it's much better to think about this framework that there's some probability of effect, and we're trying to see when we incorporate new evidence of how protests have shaped government behavior, whether that shifts our distribution of the world in terms of how we understand the probability of that effect to exist.
Okay.
So we might start with this idea that, like, well, there's probably an effect of people protesting. Like, no one likes to be yelled at. Government officials seem to care what their population thinks. So we start with this. There's probably some prior effect that we think it exists.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go around the world and we observe how governments do indeed change their behavior or don't when people come out into the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were just being naive and we didn't think about any other variables influencing why people came out, we just may count the number of times where protests led to more government change and in times where they didn't, and then just add that up with our basic prior that there probably was an effect and see how we are afterwards. And that's what we call the posterior distribution.
So there's still, like, with that framework, like, how do you come up with that original prior, right? I know some people, they'll throw around just like domain knowledge, but, like, what does that even mean?
The nice thing about Bayesian statistics is if you've had previous statistical analyses, now there's always the first question of what was the original prior, but let's just abstract from what the first prior was before there was any tests.
Okay.
Bayesian statistics is very nice in that if you had some other statistician who did a Bayesian analysis before, they had a posterior distribution. So they started with a prior that they inherited from someone else, say. They looked at some new data. They combined the prior with the new data, what we call the likelihood.
Right.
They'd find something proportional to that we call the posterior.
Mm-hmm.
You could then take that posterior or the combination of new evidence plus existing knowledge, take that as your starting prior and carry on with it. And so this idea of how knowledge sort of propagates to the system feels a lot like the way humans think, right?
Oh.
I start with my idea of how the world works. I talk to you. You may sort of change my opinion.
Right.
I have a new state of how I think the world is. I talk to my mother. She has a way of, she thinks the world does. I'm now incorporating my baseline knowledge with what you've told me to see how my mother gets influenced. And so there's a sort of natural flow to that. And so in that sense, Bayesian statistics has a nice appeal.
Right.
Now, there are some things where it feels weird to apply Bayesian statistics. So let's say I want to ask whether or not the Earth revolves around the Sun in a certain type of orbit, right? So I have to start with that prior that whether or not the Earth revolves around the Sun in this certain orbit.
Right.
And it seems strange to say putting a prior probability on that the Earth does not revolve around the Sun.
Yeah, because it seems like a binary outcome.
Yeah,
either
some things just feel like they are or they aren't.
Yeah.
But a Bayesian has to be able to assign a probability to everything.
Mm.
So there are some cases where we don't feel that the question should be probabilistic, but yet we still have to do that. So there are two issues, I'd say, like you said. The first one is, how did you get the original prior?
Yeah.
And whether or not all events should be probabilistically modeled.
I see. Let's kind of move on towards more what kind of advice would you have for anyone that is even just reading about some kind of statistical analysis in some kind of a paper, someone is saying, oh, they found this significant difference in some scientific paper. Can you give some general advice for what are the key things to look for that you could say that reinforces your trust in this paper or this finding, or even maybe if there are some omissions that you should make you think twice about trusting a paper?
It's actually quite hard. So on the one hand, there might be some specialized statistical knowledge you have that would say, that was just an inappropriate statistical test you ran for this type of study, or you didn't do family-wise error, false discovery rate correction. So there might be some technical issues with the paper that would cause you to lose confidence in it.
Right.
For most people that don't have that training, it's very difficult to know.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's like a generally like a quite a second-order concern. Most academics are they spend most of their time making sure that the statistical tools are appropriate in this idea that the way I think the data is produced, I should have the best possible tool for it. But there are so many other issues around forking paths, the quality of the data, the reasonableness of the hypothesis, that those should come first. So again, with the garden of forking paths, you have to ask yourself, if this is a study of, say, 20 or 30 people, were any of those people omitted or dropped for some reason they appeared to be outliers? That should instantly raise red flags, right? You already have such a small population. So if there's any studies where you're taking people out of your study, it's going to be quite problematic. The second is just the reasonableness of the hypothesis. So if you're Daryl Bem in the Audis seeing if you can detect ESP, you have to ask yourself, why are you wasting money and resources on trying to test such a stupid hypothesis, right? Or people that are very obsessed about, say, IQ differences between humans, right? It's like, it's not that there couldn't be one, it's just that you're dealing with such a noisy variable, IQ, which is a product of, well, on one level, probably intelligence, but also so many other things, like, you know, what you had for breakfast that morning, and like, did you go to private school, right? And so you're trying to measure a very noisy variable or signal with scarce resources, and it just doesn't seem like a good use of time. And is it elucidating any of the actual biological pathways? So I think that the reasonableness of the hypothesis really matters, which is actually in some sense what a Bayesian analysis can help with, right? And so that if you, because Bayesian statistics is not the primary method of statistics done in most academic papers, although it is increasing in importance and frequency, pun not intended, by forcing the researchers to state their prior, you see how they think about the world.
Right.
So what would Daryl Bem have put as his prior for ESP existing?
Yes.
Right? Because if he has basically put that there's almost no chance that ESP exists, which again is this weird idea of assigning probabilities to different states of the world, but at least it would be revealing, right? Because if he put a low enough probability of ESP existing as a prior, then having a 53% chance of this predicting image type B, which is different than 50%, say, statistically,
right,
but it wouldn't be enough to move the prior to anything that's statistically significant.
Right.
So another way you can think about frequentist statistics is that you're putting a uniform prior on all outcomes. That every outcome is just as likely as every other outcome.
So to kind of summarize there, if you're reading a paper, almost you should be reading it with your own priors about what this paper is claiming to have found.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, and all the ways that skeletons could have been hidden in the closet.
Right.
So the more convoluted the data processing and just the appendix becomes, and not mathematically, I mean all of the different data steps that were taken, the more skeptical you instantly have to be.
Right.
Because there are just now so many more ways the data could have been cut.
Makes
right?
sense.
Like, if you can... you're a computer scientist, Jared, so you understand the way that these things scale non-polynomially. They're combinatorials,
sure.
right? If I have three data adjustment type 1s and four data adjustment type 2s and five data adjustment type 3s, I'm already at more than 100 possible combinations of different adjustments, right? It's just going
to
scale.
Close to,
whatever the math is. But the point is, when I add one more combination, it interacts with all existing other combinations,
exactly.
So my results keep growing exponentially.
Yeah.
So those are things that you need to think about when you see these studies.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Makes sense. Kind of there's been this discussion, I think, just in the general scientific community about the reproducibility crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the solutions that I've heard being put forward is, can we learn causal models? And I know intuitively myself that learning causation tends to be very difficult, and it seems like the only way to do it is with these randomized controlled trials. What is your take on that? Do you think that kind of moving towards trying to learn causation might be a way to make these findings more reproducible or more generalizable? What's your take?
Almost none of the reproducibility crisis is because of lack of causal modeling.
Oh, okay.
Almost certainly. I mean, so for that to be the case, it would have to be that you did biased trials. So you did statistics on confounded processes. That is, that there was another factor that you didn't measure that was actually driving the process that you erroneously attributed to something else.
Mm-hmm.
Then you ran a proper trial, quote unquote, where you actually accounted for this other variable, like say through a randomized control trial, so that because the assignment is random, there can't be another variable that influences that.
Right.
And then you found that there was actually no effect when you originally found there was an effect. And this is absolutely not what is happening. What is happening is that almost identical trial designs are being implemented a second time, and they're not even recovering the first trial, let alone if that trial was even appropriately set up. It's a much different question. Right.
Okay.
So for Daryl Bem's case, the case isn't that Daryl Bem didn't have a causal model of ESP. The problem is that ESP doesn't exist, so that when I rerun the trial, you're not going to find anything.
Well, that seems like an extreme case. I don't think many people expect the ESP trial to be reproducible.
No. So the bigger issues are, say, you're doing genetics trials, and as you know, that when you measure biological specimens through these machines, that there can be these technical factors that have nothing to do with biology that creep in, and so you erroneously misattribute biology just to technical variation in your measurement devices. There can be the fact that your populations don't generalize to the overall populations. There could be the fact that even though you have many measurements, they were derived from a small set of actual individuals. So a lot of biological experiments might be based on multiple cells, but from only three mice. So
right.
Each cell from that mouse is treated as a different sample. But those three mice just might be very specific. And they
right.
might have characteristics that just don't generalize to other mice when you do the new trial.
Mm-hmm.
There are all sorts of reasons why this is the case. Then there's just what's called the file drawer effect, which is that if you have many researchers that are studying ESP, but only the ESP studies that found a statistically significant difference are going to be published, that's even accounting for the false discovery rate or family-wise error rate adjustment. It doesn't matter. It's just that as a society, we only ever see the studies that have the largest effect.
Right.
So at a minimum, the next study will probably find a smaller effect if multiple people were running studies before that and yours was the first one that found an effect.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's actually almost the same mechanism, just on a higher level to the multiple hypothesis testing.
It is, exactly. Right. It's the multiple hypothesis testing problem across researchers.
Right.
So there's this, and there's not an easy answer to it. You know, if you're a researcher and you're testing 10,000 genes, well, you adjust for the fact that you've run 10,000 hypothesis tests. What if you found out that your next door scientific neighbor was also testing 10,000 genes? Do you need to adjust for 20,000 genes because he tested 10,000 of them?
Right.
No. You're saying, well, that's his experiment. I don't need to adjust mine for his. But if you're both competing for publishing space, then in some sense you should have collectively adjusted for 20,000.
Right.
Or you do another test the next day. You're not accounting for the fact that you adjusted those 10,000 genes yesterday because it feels like a completely different experiment. But again, you're selecting your research over your career, so it has the same effect.
Mm,
yeah. And I don't even think the file drawer problem is the biggest issue either. That might be 10 to 20% of the problem. But the causal model one is very limited. What I will say is the causal modeling problem doesn't impact the reproducibility crisis in my view, but it is really good to think about. So there might be perpetually bad results that keep coming back, perpetually bad results that keep reproducing, because
right.
you're not thinking about the causality well, right? So we might consistently find differences between IQ for whatever, comparisons, populations, or ages, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But it's just because you're not accounting for all of the obvious social confounding processes that go on in that, right?
Right.
So why even bother to measure this thing which is a proxy of a proxy for the thing you care about, right?
Okay.
Yeah, so that's where having causal models would be useful. But then once you realize that you actually have no mechanism for identifying causality, you should abandon your research pursuit.
Yeah.
So economists actually think quite carefully about this problem for a lot of areas. So they might say, like, well, if we want to measure the impact of minimum wage on the unemployment rate, you know, we can't just look at which cities instituted a minimum wage, or a higher minimum wage, rather, because the cities that do that are non-random.
Right.
Right? And so unless you have a very, very clear mechanism that can tease out that causality, it's going to be hard. So an example might be that you have two state lines where a city's on both sides of a state. It's between, say, New Jersey and New York State. The city's economic fortunes are presumably quite identical between the river that separates them, the state line.
Yep.
But New York State happened to pass a minimum wage law. And so you can see how unemployment changes on one side of the city and not the other.
Mm.
Those are natural experiments that get much closer to what the equivalent of a randomized control trial would be.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it almost feels random the application of the minimum wage.
If it was truly random, then it would be an unbiased effect. But then you get into the problem, which again is, that's just addressing the causal mechanism. But is this one city that happens to be on two state lines really representative of all American cities?
Mm.
It's probably true that in that city, the minimum wage either did or did not have an effect, whatever side the results come out. But do you think that generalizes to, say, a city that's on either side of Washington State and Oregon? Maybe not, right?
There are some then kind of specific topics in statistics that I think could be very interesting to touch on. One of these is almost kind of the inverse, I think, of this multiple hypothesis correction, and this is the winner's curse. As I understand it, this seems to be the effect where, as you report some significance, right, it's cut off because if it had been a small effect size that you had detected, because it was on the low end of the different distribution, then perhaps it wouldn't have been labeled as significant. And so really, all of your significant findings are getting drawn from this kind of artificial threshold and then upwards. And so then that's kind of shifting the effect size that you're actually going to find. I was wondering if you could go in more detail around this particular phenomenon that we're seeing.
So the winner's curse, I think its origins come from auction markets. This idea that when you have multiple competing bids for something, whoever wins the bid almost certainly overpaid for it.
Okay.
And tying that into statistics is, in the same way that there's this threshold, you either cross the threshold or you don't. Although in these statistical tests, multiple things could cross the threshold. In an auction, only one person can cross the threshold.
Right.
But the principle is the same. Once you establish a threshold, if you happen to be on the right side of it, you probably are larger than what you would be normally. Because the point is, everything to the left side of that threshold never gets observed.
Mm-hmm.
So even if the process is generated on average to the left of that threshold, you only ever see things to the right of it.
Right.
Right.
So let's bring that back to the auction.
Mm.
So you said something about there'd be overpaying.
Yeah.
So what's some intuition about that?
So let's say that on average, Monet's paintings have some average distribution of value.
Right.
Right. But some people are to the right of that average, and some people are to the left of that average.
They think that it's worth less or worth more than
more
the kind of mean of everyone's.
And let's assume that, which is reasonable, that the average assessment of the valuations is actually the correct one. Right?
Okay.
This is usually true. And almost by definition in a market, that's what is true.
Right?
Right. Because the market returns are going to be what the average valuation of a stock or a painting is going to be.
Right. Makes sense.
Okay. So if you've won the painting auction for one of the paintings, you probably had a higher than average assessment of Monet's value.
Yeah. Because you had to have been the person that was willing to pay the most.
Exactly.
Of the people that were in present, right?
Correct.
Oh,
correct.
Okay.
And that's why, if you tried to then resell it, almost by definition, there will be fewer people that are willing to pay what you did for the painting.
Right.
If that was your goal of accurately assessing it.
Huh. producing. Right. And that's then probably why a lot of people like selling these incredibly expensive things at auctions, because that seems to maximize your return on a single good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That could be. I don't know. I haven't thought about that, actually.
No? Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I guess just intuitively, just from this one conversation, if the person that's winning the auction is generally higher than the mean, if you have only one of something and you wanted to get the most value out of that good, then probably the auction would get you the best price for all the people in that room.
The principle generally applies that whenever you apply a max over many things, that max will be higher than what the average is. Yes.
Right. Fair enough.
Yeah. So the same thing is true with statistically significant findings. It's not that they're not real. It's just that you are going to observe the effects at their highest value or highest measurement relative to their true mean. So in statistics, we imagine that there's a true effect size, and then there's variation around that. Mm-hmm. And so if you're saying that something looks like an effect, you've probably seen it in its most extreme form. Okay. It's not that it doesn't exist, it's just that you've observed it at a higher concentration than usual.
Right.
Yeah.
We thought, because we did Canadian politics last time, we wanted to tag on a few minutes just about the events that just happened today. So actually, I'll pose it to you, Eric. So Andrew Scheer just resigned this morning from the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
Did you see this coming? Is this a surprise to you? And then I've also been hearing that there are rumors that the National Post is going to release an article about Andrew Scheer having paid for his kids' education through money from the Conservative Party. So taking into balance these things, how much do you think that it's because he's trying to get away from this scandal, and how much do you think that it is because they had lost the election that people are pushing him out?
It's hard to say, and so just, I think just to clarify, I think it's not that Scheer, he hasn't left the caucus, he hasn't left the party.
No.
He's stepping down as leader, and I believe he said he will step down when a new leader is found.
Yeah, so he's, well, that's still up to the, I believe, the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
But he said that he would like to stay on as interim leader until someone else is chosen. Yeah.
So, best case for Scheer, he stays on as interim leader until whenever the new primary.
April.
Yeah, although it may be expedited. Mm-hmm. It's possible that the day that the story leaked about his new expense scandal, which we don't fully know a lot about, could be the reason why he's also resigning. I think it's probably unlikely that those two things happened on the same day. It's usually hard to sync that up.
Yeah.
He probably had to think about, he would have had to have a meeting with his caucus. He would have had to schedule that. He couldn't have scheduled it the same morning, right? Because not everyone would have been awake.
That's true.
He probably would have had to do that before. So I'm guessing that he may have learned that this might be an issue or that it might come out. But I think generally just the bad feedback he received across the country,
right?
So he did this, like, apology tour isn't the right word, but sort of a shame tour might be a better way to put it.
He went
to almost every, like, conservative riding and talked to the people there, and he got frosty receptions from a lot of them outside of the prairies, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think that was really hard on him. And you have, a leader cannot stand for very long when there is open dissension in the ranks.
Right.
Right. So it's a strong leader can handle some of that for a while, but at some point he has to put his foot down and snuff out any dissension.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're getting to weeks without hearing any sort of counter-revolutionary protocols being implemented suggested that it was good. It was getting close to time for him to step down anyway.
Yeah.
And he probably just did not feel that he could muster a sufficient whipping procedure to get everyone in line, and he had to step down.
Right.
I've heard a little more information about the expense issue, and I think it's that when he moved from Regina or Saskatoon, wherever he's from, to Ottawa, the party offered to pay the difference in cost of living between those two cities, because it is more expensive to live in Ottawa.
Yeah.
And I think if he was sending his kids to private school in Regina, they're paying him the delta on that difference.
Which would then be probably a heck of a lot.
Especially if he's going to an elite private school where, like, diplomats are sending their kids as well.
Yeah.
So, but it obviously was a poor leadership decision, right, to do that. Especially when you're trying to talk about fiscal responsibility and how the liberals can't balance budgets. So, which is obviously a bad idea. And the fact that so few people knew about it means that he was embarrassed about it, right?
Yeah.
You should never do anything that your juniors or your seniors would be upset that you were doing. Like, that's a basic rule you should follow whether you're an employee or a boss, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I think, anyways, but I think it's good that Scheer is stepping down.
Right.
He couldn't unify the party.
Yeah.
But he talked about it, and I listened to a 6-minute speech, and like he listed all the elements, and he's right. He said there are the libertarians, there are the red Tories, there are the social conservatives, and there are the Quebec nationalists.
Right,
and that's quite a broad spectrum to bring together.
Oh yeah,
and he did not.
No,
and so maybe someone else can. Maybe
well, John. I mean, me personally. Oh well, yes. I mean, we'll get to who my favorite is in a minute.
He left the door open.
Yeah, he did leave the door open. Yeah, I see from the campaign that the Conservatives had, and I think we talked a bit about it last time, it's just that there was no new ideas that were coming out of the Conservative Party. It was like they were running a campaign that was like, do not like Trudeau, then vote for us, but we'll be exactly the same as we've always been. I feel like that's just not going to cut it anymore, right? Like if the Liberals used to try that, and then they got trounced by the NDP and the Conservatives, and were not even the official opposition anymore,
mm-hmm.
back before Trudeau. New ideas need to be coming forward in order to keep up with the times right now. The two main parties to stay relevant need to keep changing.
Yeah. I think the Liberals, well, Liberals never have any strong plans, but like they had a sort of vision. You kind of got what their sort of main thrust was going to be.
Yeah.
Much less this election than last one. And the NDP and the Greens obviously had strong agendas.
Yes.
And for some reason the Conservatives didn't. You didn't really have that vision.
Yeah. Well, there was actually this interesting article that I'd read. It was the conservative political strategist, or their kind of the Nate Silver for the Conservative Party.
Mm-hmm.
He had talked about how they had been trying to estimate the turnout for this 2019 election, and that that had surprised them. When the exit polls had come back, it had been 1 or 2 percentage points higher than their up estimates, or their revised higher estimates from when they had been going in.
Yeah.
And those people that then ended up showing up that were unanticipated ended up breaking Liberal. And that seems to have been what made the difference, especially when you look at some Quebec ridings and Ontario ridings that are only won by a few thousand votes. Like 1 or 2 percentage points of more people just showing up made all the difference. So I think it was really an enthusiasm underestimate.
Yeah.
Even though it was a lower turnout than 2016 or 2015.
But again, the raw conservative vote count basically just did not change. The Liberal vote collapsed by more than 1 million votes.
Yes.
But the raw, I mean, so ideally you don't want to, so they did increase it by like 5 or 10%, but also the population grew between, like they basically grew at the rate of the population.
Yep.
Which is not going to be enough. Like,
oh, yeah.
I think I estimated they needed at least, and this was a necessary, not a sufficient condition, like to get what, like to win a Harper-type majority, they needed like at least like 1 to 1.5 million more votes.
Right.
That's a lot of people you got to convince with your message.
Well, or more Liberals needed to stay home.
Yeah, but the Liberal vote also, relative to 2015, collapsed.
And I think what they had thought was they thought it would collapse more. Because of all the scandals and the polls that they had had throughout the summer, somehow the Liberal resolve to get out and vote somehow coalesced in the last few weeks.
I mean, if the party you're competing can lose 1.5 million votes, I don't remember what the exact number is, but you need them to lose 2.5, you're in trouble.
That's true.
If you can't win with them losing, relatively speaking, not even just in your population, more than 1 million votes, You have a problem with building a political coalition, even in First Past the Post.
So I guess you referenced it a little earlier, but let's plug, or I'm going to plug my favorite candidate from the Conservative Party. I'm a big Michael Chong fan.
Yeah.
I like him because he had one of the only platforms running for the leadership race last time that acknowledged climate change and had a reasonable plan in order to try and combat it from a conservative perspective. And I see him as a much better choice to Andrew Scheer, that kind of more center of the road, closer to the left, that can get more of those red Tories out of the Liberal caucus and into the conservative tent. Do you have a favorite, Eric, so you can have a chance to plug them here?
I don't know if I have a favorite, but I definitely think that it's hard because on the one hand, I want to just think strategically, which is that I was thinking like, okay, Michael Chong adds 20 seats in Ontario, loses two in the Prairies. They're already doing better,
yeah,
right? Like
no
just contest. Just in terms of like, if this is an economics, you want to think about balancing the margins. The problem is that it's weird to call this a problem, but if you're winning 70% of the popular vote in Alberta, you don't need that many votes in first past the post.
Yeah.
It's okay to lose a bit of enthusiasm in Alberta if it brings it to the seats where you need it the most.
Yeah.
Right? But on the other hand, I do also think that the Conservatives need a vision. So I'm sort of torn between, okay, should we put in Chong or Ambrose, more kind of soft politicians that will connect with people. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that they have a conservative vision either, right? Mm-hmm. I personally would like to see, and maybe this is Peter McKay, I don't know, but I would like to see a conservative who really focuses on kind of a foreign policy vision.
Mm.
Actually kind of really bringing back human rights and making new alliances with Western countries. And Scheer kind of talked about that,
right.
but I really think you could bring together people that might not normally think of voting conservative. This idea, it's like, look, like the world's becoming an increasingly dangerous place. Now, we either form a coalition with other democratic powers to put accountability on places like Turkey, on places like China, or we let human rights continue to be curtailed abroad. Now, maybe you say, that's all well and good, but ultimately, we just need to focus on our own issues at home. But this is where you have to have the vision and the leadership to say that human rights being extinguished abroad will ultimately affect us at home. What does that mean? That means that, say, when a Tibetan student president becomes elected to the University of Scarborough, that she's not harassed by the Chinese consulate and other foreign powers, right? And even if you think that, well, there's nothing we can do to protect the Uyghur Muslims in Western China, are we okay with Chinese Canadians having their family members used as hostages and threatened that if they post anything in our country that their families will be killed or disappeared in their country there, right?
Yeah,
ultimately,
true.
These things come back to hurt us one way or the other, right? And we'll be continually to be economically dependent on countries like China who have no problem shutting off trade overnight for billions of dollars of exports, where we in turn would never do the same thing.
Yeah.
So I think it's very short-sighted to not think that foreign policy is either important or even could be like a potentially winning domestic issue, especially if we keep getting headlines about Western China, Trump, Erdogan, Putin, right?
Yeah.
All
yeah.
of these things could really potentially create a sort of a unifying theme of democratic values at home and abroad for the next leader. And so maybe someone like McKay with a defense background might have that, but I haven't heard what he has to say about it recently either.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I completely agree with you on the foreign policy. I maybe just disagree with the level of enthusiasm for the average Canadian for that. But in any case, I think we're going pretty long on this particular episode, so...
We could add Jody as the final.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
So Jody is refusing to give up her office suite that she held when she was the Minister of Justice for the new Liberal Minister of Justice. Now, to be clear, she's not saying that she's not going to be a cabinet minister. She understands she's not part of the Liberal caucus. Where this is the physical office room. She doesn't want to
move her desk.
Yeah. And she had multiple offices that were associated with her position as Minister of Justice, and so reasonably she's not saying, I continue to want all of the offices. She's saying you can have most of them, but she's keeping this one that she's in right now, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, I really like Jody Wilson-Raybould. I mean, I'm pretty much a Liberal guy through and through. I like to, talk about who's my favorite Conservative candidate, but... I can really respect Jody for sticking to her guns through the whole SNC-Lavalin scandal, getting elected as an independent in Granville, which, yeah, that's tough.
That's tough.
And now being able to, like, stand up for her own office, like, mad props. She's amazing.
And I mean, she is the Liberal Party's nightmare because, oh, for sure, she represents, especially with Trudeau always saying that reconciliation with First Nations is his number one priority.
Yeah.
Right? She has this ability to bring in the kind of honesty and integrity and reasonableness that First Nations have, like, of compromise and, like, yep, over their thousands of years of civilizational heritage.
Yeah.
And so she's like, you can have most of my office space, but I'm just going to keep this. Like, that seems very reasonable. She's willing to negotiate. She's willing to talk to them.
Yeah.
Or when she was talking about SNC, she pointed out that she's like, I have to tell the truth because I come from a culture where all of our traditions are oral.
Mm.
The history is told orally down through generations. And if you start telling lies,
yeah,
you kill your history.
Oh yeah.
And I just thought, like, I'm like, oh no, like, how is Justin going to recover from that? It's just so true. So I think it's like, she just has this amazing way of kind of representing, like, an Indigenous voice, like, in the nation's capital in a really kind of honorable and impressive way,
yeah,
that shows kind of how
she brings the integrity back to politics. I wish I'd never left.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if it's ever there, but yeah.
Okay, fair,
yeah,
enough.
But so, yeah, with that, I think we can agree that Jody is probably one of the best
politicians in the modern era.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. All right. This has been Statistically Insignificant with your co-hosts signing off. I'm Jared Hunter.
And I'm Eric Drysdale. See you next time. Bye.